Good morning. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the House Preventing Homelessness Division to order. Our clerk will take the roll to determine which members are present.
Thank you, Chair Gomez.
Gomez present.
Gomez present. Keeler?
Keeler present.
Keeler present. New Brindley?
New Brindley present.
New Brindley present. Davids?
Davids present.
Davids present. Heinrich?
Heinrich present.
Heinrich present. Hollins?
Hollins present.
Hollins present. Hornstein?
Hornstein present.
Hornstein present. Howard? Howard? Cagle?
Present.
Cagle present. Petersburg?
Petersburg present.
Petersburg present. Ryer? Ryer?
Ryer present.
A quorum is present.
Thank you. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of our last meeting, March 24th, 2021?
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes.
Representative Keeler moves approval of the minutes for March 24th, 2021. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 24th, 2021 are approved. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you to the members for your commitment to this issue and your service on our committee, and to the members of the public who are joining us. You know, I just wanted to say a little bit about the meeting that we put together for today and why, kind of why we chose to lift up the voices that we have here today. So as we've discussed a lot in our committee last year, you know, COVID has really required an incredible transition and real kind of like flexible response from our homelessness response community, especially our emergency shelters. Many of them, you know, are congregate shelters, so people are sleeping kind of in proximity together without physical distancing, without separation, without private spaces. And so, you know, we had to really quickly decongregate shelter. We had, you know, some federal dollars to help put people up in hotels and come up with some temporary solutions. Most of that money is gone. And as we know, you know, some of the danger and risk associated with COVID, especially for people living in congregate settings and for those with low vaccine uptake, that danger remains. And so, you know, I kind of wanted to use this first meeting to get a little bit of a status update. You know, as we discussed, this terrain is really kind of diverse. Like, our homelessness response system, it consists of a lot of different people. It consists of governments and direct service provider agencies and private, you know, philanthropy and religious organizations, and communities really show up for these efforts in a lot of different ways. So, you know, it won't be possible for us to get a full kind of spectrum of where we're at with this meeting, but what we have done is invited our Interagency Council on Homelessness to kind of give us a status update about like how things have been for, you know, those folks who are experiencing homelessness and who are, you know, leading the response in these times, especially over the last 6 months that we haven't had committee meetings. We also know that many of our counties, especially our core metro counties, have used the federal stimulus dollars in really, you know, flexible and innovative and really critical ways. And so we have Hennepin County Commissioner Angela Conley joining us. And finally, as we have always done in this committee so far, I guess I say always, like this is our second session. So, but, you know, we really, I think that there's like a way that so many of us who serve in this body are really disconnected from the struggle that the economic struggle and some of the, you know, kind of, you know, systemic and then also personal struggles that so many people experiencing homelessness face. And so it's really important that we hear directly from people who have experienced homelessness. And so that's kind of the final part of today's meeting. And, you know, I want to say a couple things about, you know, that one thing that's interesting about being the chair is that now, since this, you know, this is a new committee, and since it exists, people from around the state, representatives from around the state reach out to me when there are issues in their local communities around homelessness. And I want to say that, you know, we're going to start hearing bills next week. And one of the cores of what I think we need to do this year, I mean, in a time of huge surplus, is that we have a chance to really make a difference in this system that has been underfunded for so long. And one of those pieces is the fact that in greater Minnesota, in many areas, even in regional population centers, there's little to no infrastructure for emergency homelessness response. And so one of the centerpieces of my proposal this year for the budget and the governor's supplemental budget that he's presented is about getting shelter built around the state so that it's not only in kind of the metro and regional population centers that people can receive the support that they need to stabilize in their lives. We want people to be able to be in their home communities, to be close to their families and their friends and their support systems, and not have to travel if they have needs, you know, around shelter and basic necessities. You know, the other thing that I want to mention is that when we, you know, we're facing issues around encampments, around shelter operations, around, you know, a real need for investment in unaccompanied young people from 16 to 24 who are really in this critical period of their lives, trying to stabilize themselves economically and kind of get established for the rest of their lives. There is a need around services for young people in that same age who have been the victims of sexual exploitation. And so, you know, as we go through our bills, we have a really quick session, but you'll kind of see some of those themes come up. And finally, we're going to turn to our testifiers, but I just wanted to mention that, you know, like I said, I mean, one of the things that I want to do with this committee and that you guys have been very generous in coming along with us is just to really center the voices of impacted people. And I want to just say that I think when word kind of got around that we were having this hearing, that I had a lot of people who have personally experienced homelessness reach out to me with a desire to come and share their experiences with us as policymakers so that we can understand the realities of their lives. And, you know, we only have time for a few voices today, but I just want to say that, you know, that we appreciate the generosity of people wanting to share their stories, that we're going to make space for that as we move along through this, and that, you know, to the folks who have reached out, that we appreciate it, and we're going to find time to hear from you. And also, you know, that some of these same folks, a woman, Melanie, who reached out to me to invite me and any members who want to join us to come and to go and visit an encampment in Minneapolis where she lives. And I hope that you know, we're going to be reaching out, and I hope that we can, you know, get together just to go and talk to folks who are out there, who are experiencing the issues that our committee is designed to address and prevent, just to gain a deeper understanding. And so again, I thank Melanie for her generosity in that invitation. So first of all, we're going to hear a session update from the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness. All of our committee members are familiar with our friends at MICH, as we call it. MICH is comprised of 11 state agencies, the Met Council, and the Governor's Office, and is accountable for leading the state's effort to achieve housing stability for all Minnesotans. So we'll have time for members to ask questions after the presentation. But for now, if we could just hold them until the end, and then we'll deal with them then. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kathy Tenbrook, who's the executive director of MICH, to introduce her team and go on with her presentation.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, and thank you all very much for having us here today. Just an honor to be with you again. Before we begin, I would want to introduce who's going to be doing the presentation today from our team. So I'm Kathy Tenbrook. I'm the executive director of the Interagency Council. Eric Grumdahl is here today as well. He's the deputy director of the council, and Elizabeth Dressel, who is our implementation coordinator and equity specialist. And thank you, Chair Gomez, for reminding everybody what the Interagency Council was. I think that's helpful. And it is essentially a cabinet level body, but it is very much charged with working with the broader community and our partners all across the state to drive the interagency work to create housing stability and prevent and end homelessness. And what we are asked to come bring you today, as you heard from Chair Gomez, is essentially just some information that can ground the committee again in the scale of the need as it relates to homelessness and housing instability in Minnesota, and what some of the most critical gaps are that we are seeing and that our partners across the state are seeing as well. So with that, I'll dive right in. So this first graph you see is really our attempt to give you a quick visual, and there's a lot of words on these graphs, so you'll have, of course, all these slides. We won't dwell on them too long because there's a lot to share, but this hopefully gives you just a quick visual of the scale of the need as it relates to housing instability in Minnesota, starting, of course, with the largest number of people, which are cost-burdened homeowners. We know from Minnesota Housing, for example, that roughly 60,000 homeowner households in Minnesota are currently behind on their mortgage payments and may need some assistance. And then we go to cost-burdened renters, which is a little bit of a smaller group, but not by much. And those are renters that are paying about more than 30% of their income on their housing. And in some cases, as we know well, people are paying 50, 60, 70, 80% of their income on their housing. So they are all included in that category. Doubled up is harder to measure in Minnesota. It's harder to find the data that is a perfect match. We do have data, however, on doubled up households that are what we call overcrowded, meaning that there are more than two people per bedroom in a home. And so that is who's included in this number. And then finally, the sheltered and unsheltered number estimates around almost 8,000 people on any given night in Minnesota who are experiencing homelessness. And while that's not a perfect count and certainly is an undercount, it is based on a methodology we use annually to get that number. So the next slide will show some of the strategies that are used to address gaps for people along the whole continuum of these housing needs. And as you see from this graph, some of the strategies are very specific to one of the groups. However, many of them do cross-cut and are really kind of critical strategies to address gaps for all of these categories. So for, of course, preventing homelessness in the first place is one of the most important things we can do. And then affordable housing preservation, making sure that we have housing that stays affordable, that we're preserving the stock that we have, targeting financial assistance, providing supports to keep people in the housing that they have. Those are all strategies that impact all of these groups. And then, of course, as we get to more of the folks who are doubled up or overcrowded and experiencing unsheltered or sheltered homelessness, that's where some of our key strategies around our shelter investments and crisis response system are so critical. Next slide, please. So I think I showed this to you before. You might remember this picture from last year, but I thought it was worth sharing just one more time, just to remind the committee that when we talk about ending homelessness, what is it that we mean? And we don't mean that a person in Minnesota will never again have any kind of housing crisis. We know that's highly unlikely. However, we do think that we could create a system in the state of Minnesota where if somebody does have a housing crisis, there are ways to prevent that crisis from leading to homelessness. And if it does lead to homelessness, we can ensure that the episode is brief, that we quickly get people connected to housing that will work for them, and that we have the right kinds of supports in place to ensure that it doesn't happen again. So this is an animated slide here. So in what we mean really about preventing new incidents, for example, early identification of kids in schools through our Homework Starts with Home program is one way of preventing new incidents. You know, understanding their housing instability, working with them and their families, our Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program, you know, working to keep people in the housing that they have. Those are some of those examples. And then, of course, increasing, making it rare means increasing housing outcomes. And it's not just about creating new units, but ensuring that those new units will work for people experiencing homelessness, that we're engaging more landlords in the mix to ensure that there are more housing opportunities within the existing market. So a variety of ways of making it rare. Ensuring that every episode is as brief as possible. We know that homelessness is a traumatic event, especially for young people and children. And the shorter a time of homelessness as we can possibly have it be is going to ensure less trauma for those individuals. It is also far more difficult to end somebody's homelessness after they've been homeless for a longer period of time. So that's really important. And then finally, the last piece is making sure that people don't fall back into homelessness once they've exited. And this is a really important part of this work that is about ensuring the right kinds of services, supports, community connections, and really ensuring that we have all of these pieces in place. And when and if we do, this is essentially what ending homelessness looks like. You've heard us talk about ending veteran homelessness in Minnesota, and we are very, very close to achieving that goal. And it is because communities have created a system that works like this. Okay, next slide, please. I'm going to turn this over to my deputy, Eric Grumbel, to walk us through this.
Thank you, Kathy and Chair Gomez and members. My name is Eric Grumdahl, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Interagency Council on Homelessness. From a data perspective, we thought it'd be helpful to situate the spectrum of housing needs in the context of the shortage of affordable housing. This graph, which you may recall from previous discussions, focuses on Minnesotans with the lowest incomes, those earning less than 30% of the area median income, or AMI. These figures are based on data prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. We see the biggest gaps in affordable housing availability for this population. While 160,000 Minnesota households fall into this group, only 58,000 have housing priced to be affordable for 30% AMI. There are another 47,000 units that would be affordable, but which are occupied by higher income households. So we see a gap of nearly 55,000 units needed at a price affordable to 30% AMI households, but an even larger gap in affordable housing options for those households. More than 100,000 households at or below 30% AMI don't have access to housing affordable for 30% AMI. It's probably no surprise then that while this group represents about one quarter of all renters, they're nearly half of the cost burden renter households paying more than is affordable. These low-income Minnesotans are also the vast majority of severely cost-burden renters, meaning those paying more than half of their income toward rent. This next picture shows trends that we see with the point-in-time count, or PIT count, data. That's a federally mandated survey of people experiencing homelessness on a single night in January. The PIT count is only one of the data sources we use to monitor trends, and it's an important one since it lets us compare trends nationally. Here we're looking at three groups over a 7-year period of time from 2014 through 2020. The final results from the 2021 count are not yet available. The left side of this slide shows you actual numbers. The right side shows relative change since 2014. The first thing to note is that overall, homelessness in Minnesota decreased by 5% in Minnesota over this period. The count allows us to track specific subpopulations as well. And here we see the 32% decrease in homelessness among families, which we attribute to a suite of initiatives and investments that have helped better support families facing crises, increased the pace of families getting back into housing, and services that have helped families stay housed. In contrast, we see a marked increase in the number of Minnesotans who are staying outdoors, which has grown by 145% over this period. We often stress how homelessness is a statewide issue, and this dynamic really bears that out. We've seen this increase play out across the state, and in fact, the number of Minnesotans living outside in greater Minnesota communities doubled during this period. This trend mirrors dynamics observed across the country and is perhaps the most acute manifestation of the lack of affordable housing for the lowest income households. We also know that shelter capacity has never been able to keep up with demand, which motivates much of the focus and budget proposals related to shelter. This next picture, we continue to see dramatic disparities in who experiences homelessness in Minnesota. We've updated this picture that shows how likely different racial and ethnic groups are to be among various populations compared to white, non-Hispanic Minnesotans. Here, each racial and ethnic group is represented by a line. Moving from left to right, we're comparing rates of being in four different groups: the general population, people in poverty, people experiencing homelessness, and people staying outdoors without shelter. As you can see, when we move from the general population to people in poverty, we do see disparities, with African American and American Indian households being Minnesotans being 4 and 5 times more likely to be in poverty than their white non-Hispanic counterparts. When we get to homelessness, we see that these disparities explode. American Indians are 22 times more likely to experience homelessness compared to white non-Hispanic Minnesotans, and African Americans are 13 times more likely. Moreover, those disparities for American Indians increase when we get to unsheltered populations. American Indian Minnesotans are 24 times more likely to be unsheltered compared with white non-Hispanic Minnesotans. This picture underscores for us how systemic racism and inequity drive homelessness, and therefore how the response to homelessness must be rooted in confronting the issues that lead to these dramatic disparities. And next, we'd like to give you an update on the COVID-19 pandemic and response. And for that, I will turn this over to Elizabeth Dressel.
Thanks, Eric. And Chair and members of the committee, I'm Elizabeth Dressel, and I work with the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness. And we just wanted to spend a few minutes with you all today to talk a little bit about the COVID challenges that are still facing shelters and people experiencing homelessness. And unfortunately, as you all know well, COVID continues to be a challenge, especially with the Omicron surge for all Minnesotans, but we are really seeing this impact shelters. As Chair Gomez was sharing in our opening, it's really many of these settings are congregate in nature, and people experiencing homelessness are at higher risk for having chronic underlying health conditions that make them at risk for more severe illness. And our data has really shown that throughout the pandemic, that people experiencing homelessness are more likely to end up in the hospital or needing ICU level of care. For people who were sheltered at the time of their COVID diagnosis, they are 4 times more likely than the general population to be hospitalized and nearly twice as likely to need ICU level care. And those numbers see a dramatic increase when we look at people who are unsheltered at the time of contracting COVID. They are 11 times more likely than the general population to be hospitalized and 8 times more likely to be needing ICU level care. So these are folks who are extremely vulnerable to severe illness and just really lots of focus still on protecting people experiencing homelessness from COVID. So on the next slide, this just walks through the case rates among people experiencing homelessness and shelter staff. As you'll see kind of in the summer, more towards the right side of the graph, in the end of summer, as Delta hit shelters, started to see cases rise in settings, and then seeing an increasing growth with Omicron here as those last few bars, and seeing cases reach as high as they have since the beginning of the pandemic. So still very much a forefront of the experience for people and settings is managing through COVID. Onto the next slide, we'll look a little bit here at the vaccination rates among adults experiencing homelessness. This population was included in phase 1 of the vaccine rollout at the beginning of 2021. MDH contracted with vaccine providers to be able to offer vaccines directly at shelter settings and out in community where people are to make it as easy to access. But really are a number of factors that play into why we are seeing still lower vaccination rates than the general population. really one, the adaptation of getting vaccine, moving it from, you know, a hospital or clinic out into a shelter setting or out into community was one challenge that we worked through. Another is just thinking about needing two doses. And if you aren't sure where you're going to sleep tonight or tomorrow, thinking 3 weeks ahead and planning can be a challenge in making sure people come for a follow-up second dose or now a booster. Additionally, we have repeatedly heard throughout the pandemic that people experiencing homelessness are managing through a crisis. They are managing and prioritizing many different things in their day-to-day lives. And while COVID-19 vaccinations are important, it might not rise to the top of the things that they need to manage for that day or for that point in their life. And so, while it's not just vaccine hesitancies that's leading to some of these lower rates, it is the things that go into managing through a crisis. And so you'll see there on the left-hand side of the graph, 42% of people experiencing homelessness have at least one shot. So lower than we would hope and than the general population, but you'll see that that is continuing to increase. And we attribute that to strategies that are working, targeted resources and incentive programs and building trusting relationships with people who are already working in these communities. The right side of this graph shows that data broken out by race and ethnicity. Wanting to highlight, you'll see that American Indian population that's experiencing homelessness has relatively comparable vaccination rates to a white Minnesotans experiencing homelessness. And one thing that we see with that is that there was really early and ongoing partnership with tribal entities, tribal public health, and local partners and nonprofits that had these existing relationships with folks that were able to offer vaccines, have conversations, provide incentives that really work for the community. And so trying to increase those strategies of really giving out information and resources and incentives and letting communities who know these folks best decide what is going to work for continuing to get more individuals vaccinated, because that continues to be a priority. Another way that we're doing that is MDH's partnership with nonprofits to operate a trusted messenger program that is really about that, continuing to build on trusted relationships to get people the information they need, access to incentives that might incentivize them to feel ready to get vaccinated. So if we move to the next slide, this is just some highlights here of where we are in the ongoing pandemic response. When we were with you all last spring, I think we gave an overview of the early pandemic response. And so I'm not gonna go into all of those details we shared last year, but just as a reminder, some highlights was quick, rapid deployment of $96 million for settings who are rapidly trying to protect people in those early days of COVID. So that was deconcentrating shelters and standing up isolation spaces, accessing PPE and all of those things. Partners across the state stood up nearly 3,000 temporary shelter sites to really work to protect people. And so that was kind of some of the few things we talked about last year. This slide overviews where we are right now and kind of the focused strategies. As Delta came into shelters in the late summer, $10 million in federal fiscal recovery funds was set aside to support shelters as they manage through these outbreaks. And so these are funds that are operated by the Office of Economic Opportunity at the Department of Human Services on a rolling basis to get funds out rapidly as shelters are seeing a crisis from COVID. And this can support staff, temporary staff, isolation spaces, hazard pay for staff as they have to isolate and quarantine. The MDH Congregate Living Response Team continues to provide extensive technical assistance for shelters. They are currently supporting 36 sites with active outbreaks. So this is a team that is available to shelters to provide guidance and answer questions and make sure they have the resources they need to keep people safe through their outbreaks. As I mentioned on the last slide, the Trusted Messenger Program, and really working to have targeted incentives to support vaccine outreach, really giving communities the tools and resources they need to do what's going to work best, because they know their communities best. Kathy and Dan Pollock from the Department of Human Services continue to co-chair the At-Risk Populations Work Group, which was stood up at the beginning of the pandemic response. And they continue to provide briefings to MDH leadership and the governor's office about these settings and what is needed to make sure they're having the needed supports to continue to respond to COVID and support people experiencing homelessness. Just last week, a partnership between Serve Minnesota and Worldwide Travel Staffing to stand up a new emergency staffing pool for shelters. One of the things we kept hearing from providers as they were being hit with Omicron is the need to have staff to maintain continuity of shelter operations, and having temporary emergency staff as they manage these crises is a challenge and something that this pool is seeking to fulfill by sending out temporary staff on shift by shift basis to fill the need so shelters can continue their operations. And then we continue to have engagement and connection with providers and partners across the state through weekly provider webinars. We began these in March of 2020 and hold them every Wednesday and typically have between 100 and 130 folks across the state coming to hear updates from our state team. It's a space for people to get questions answered. And really what we have found is an ongoing and direct way to hear from providers, hear what they need, get input from them, and a way to stay connected. And so on the next slide, we wanted to just bring to you all some of the challenges that we've been hearing directly through those channels of challenges settings are experiencing as they manage their COVID, through COVID. And they're here. I'm sure some of them are not things that are terribly surprising, but just knowing that these are things we are continuing to hear over the months of the response, you know, as Eric was mentioning earlier, access to affordable housing that's actually affordable to folks, partnerships with landlords, being able to have places for people to transition out of shelters and encampments and into permanent housing, finding and hiring staff, what many settings are experiencing, just having enough staff and the continuity of staff to maintain operations is really a challenge. Supporting the resilience, mental health, and well-being of staff and clients. This is a really hard space to be working and living in this crisis. And so many staff or many providers just sharing the need to be making sure people have their mental health needs so that they can be resilient, that they are well as we move through these challenging times. Additional funding to operate and expand shelter and outreach and housing programs, wanting to do more of that is what we're hearing. And then just the continued challenge of the acute COVID responses, you know, when you have an outbreak and you have staff out, how do you manage to keep your doors open, access to testing for clients and staff, isolation space for those who need to isolate safely, and just really working to keep people safe through this. And that is the focus of what we're prioritizing and doing, and input like this and working to address these challenges is what guides our team's work moving forward. And so I'm going to turn it back to Kathy to talk about that.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. And Chair Gomez, I know time is tight, so I'll be very brief in these last couple of slides. But I think you said it the best, Chair Gomez, at the beginning, that COVID has really put a spotlight on the challenges and inequities that people experiencing homelessness face as it relates to public health and housing instability. So I just wanted to share with you really quickly a new orientation for the work of the Interagency Council on Homelessness. Given all that we have learned over the last 2 years through COVID, we are really excited to say that the council has charged us to work with our partners all across the state to move in the direction of creating a more justice-oriented plan for our work as state agencies and in concert with our partners. And so what this graph shows you is essentially an evolution of the decades of work being done on this issue. And it's really trying to show that while, you know, we don't see this as linear and we're probably somewhere in the middle of this graph right now in terms of our work, our goal and our desire and our vision is to move towards justice. So essentially moving away from just simply creating programs and that target people experiencing homelessness to really, frankly, identifying homelessness as a form of injustice, to really identify that homelessness is rooted in historic racial housing and homelessness policies and current policies, and frankly that housing instability is not just an individual issue, but frankly a public health issue and should be treated as a public health issue, as we've learned very well during this pandemic. So the first step of all of this work is to bring people who are closest to the issue, people with lived experience of homelessness, people who are doing this work every day on the front lines, and have them help really define what housing, racial, and health justice really means. And then we will use that collective definition to really drive our next strategies and actions. So very exciting work, and we just wanted to make sure you knew that this was the focus now of the council. Next slide, please. As Elizabeth mentioned, we meet with those providers weekly. That has been just absolutely invaluable for us to get input on a weekly basis from partners all across the state. And frankly, we're never going to go back to a time where we're not doing that anymore. We started it during COVID and we will never not do that because it has been so important to our work and be able to share information and to get really valuable guidance and information from folks. So when we were in the process of thinking about the development of a supplemental budget, we asked the question to the providers, you know, where would you prioritize investments given what you know about the gaps and the issues facing people experiencing homelessness? And here were their answers. You know, obviously creation of affordable and supportive housing, prevention, increased shelter capacity, services, rent subsidies. So not surprising, but really helpful to get this kind of input and feedback from the community. And the next slide, my final point is just to share with you that that was really critical to us as we brought forward what is now in the housing stability package in the Walz-Flanagan budget. And so I just wanted you, I know the purpose of this hearing is not at all to talk about the governor's budget, but I wanted you to have access to it. There's the full summary there of the housing stability package. It is essentially a monumental shift in the way that we would invest in housing stability in Minnesota. 35 line items, 19 new programs for everything from capital to shelter to housing first for domestic violence victims to preservation of naturally occurring affordable housing. And then, you know, to answer the call of where people said they wanted to see the investments go, a doubling of our prevention assistance dollars and rental assistance through the Housing Trust Fund, a very significant increase in the Homeless Youth Act, and of course, the big increase in shelter services and operations across the state, about a fivefold increase over the current investments. So excited about this budget and certainly wanted you to have access to all the details. So with that, Chair Gomez, we will stop and take a breath and answer any questions you have.
All right, thank you so much, team. That was really great information. We're really thankful for the update. I guess as I'm looking at it, I just wanted to say a couple things. I'm really excited about the governor's budget too. We'll make sure that this gets sent out to members of the committee and that there's a link included so you can look at the holistic way that homelessness is addressed in his budget, because as we know, right, it kind of cuts across a number of different departments and kind of interest areas and funding sources. So that's very exciting. Two things that just leap out to me are the issues around workforce that all industries are facing. But, you know, I mean, these jobs are hard, right? Working in shelter, in emergency response it's hard work, sort of mentally, emotionally, and sometimes physically. And so, you know, that's kind of a lens that I think we need to view our work through. I know that the governor's budget has a couple of proposals around workforce issues. And also just, you know, I really appreciate hearing from service providers what their priorities are. You know, those are the people around our state who are in our communities on the front lines, delivering services on, you know, on behalf of the government and of, you know, to try to meet the needs of people experiencing homelessness. And so it's really important that we see that you know, there's a need to build new shelter, to put more money into prevention and all those issues that were identified there. So thank you so much. Just looking to see if anybody has. Let's go to Lead New Brindley. Do you have questions, comments?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's nice to see you. It's good to be back. I have quite a few questions, I hope. I think most of them will be quick. As I go through the slides, and first of all, thank you so much for the presentation. It was in some ways helpful. Just a comment on the shortage of housing affordability. I hope that this is an area that we can all work together as Democrats and Republicans and finally take a real look at the regulatory environment around building homes in Minnesota. Because you know what? We charge 30% more than any of our surrounding states, and we cannot keep doing this. We got to do something different. I also hope that Representative Keeler and I worked a little bit on sacred settlements last time around, and I know that the bill was pulled, but I hope that we will bring the stakeholders together and actually figure out a solution there. There are absolutely innovative things that we can and should be doing. My question for Mr. Grumdahl, I'm wondering, I know that the numbers that we have, particularly the point in time numbers, don't include 2021. When can we expect to see those numbers?
Madam Chair and Representative, no problem. And Representative Brindley, the timing for the federal release of those data is unpredictable. It varies year to year, and so we haven't gotten any signal of when those might be released. But would be happy to update the committee as soon as we have that information.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Grumdahl. That's helpful. And certainly we would want to see that, obviously. So thank you for that. Going down, Ms. Dressel, I'm wondering on the COVID numbers, we see the numbers of cases spiking recently, as we have across the board, that those numbers certainly are just not just in this community. I am wondering if the numbers of hospitalizations and ICU usage has also followed the trends of the general public, and have those numbers not spiked in the same way? Or is that population for some reason still seeing the higher, I mean, maybe higher than the general population, but have they also come down with the more recent spike?
Ms. Dressel?
Chair Gomez and Representative New Brindley, I don't have in front of me any of the raw numbers about number of people, but those numbers I shared about the rates of more likely, those have continued as we've seen cases. We continue to update. So we are still seeing people who are sheltered are 4 times more likely to need hospital level care than the general population and 2 times more likely to need ICU level care. And then folks who are unsheltered, those numbers are higher, 11 times more likely to be hospitalized and 8 times more likely to need ICU level care.
Okay. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that. You also mentioned incentives on the next slide. You had mentioned incentives. And I'm wondering when we're talking about vaccinations, and I'm wondering what kinds of incentives were offered to folks in this population to encourage vaccine usage?
Ms. Dressel?
Thanks, Chair Gomez and Representative Brindley. Good question. So that is really, it varies, but it is about a lot of times what working best is real-time incentives, so not mailing after the fact, but in real-time being able to hand out a gift card, being able to provide food and other things at vaccine events that are happening across the state. But having something there for people to get at the moment of their vaccination. And I'll welcome my colleagues, if there's other examples that you can remember that are good to highlight.
But anybody else have anything to add, or?
Madam Chair.
Okay, yep, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, and I guess I would just ask for clarification. I mean, I know that there were incentives for the general population with gift cards at a certain point, right? Those weren't available the entire time. So were they the same incentives? Were they different incentives than the general public? Was this a different program from the main incentive program, or was this just the same incentives offered at these events?
Ms. Dressel?
And Madam Chair and Representative Brindley, if I can take a crack at responding
sure.
to that, Eric Grumdahl again. One of the most innovative incentive strategies that we were able to help support was actually philanthropically funded, and so was really able to let the organizations working most closely with people that are unsheltered or who are otherwise experiencing homelessness kind of design their specific kind of response using very flexible philanthropic funds, which were informed by and in many ways mirrored some of the standing incentives. They weren't duplicative of the existing incentives. So, for example, the CDC-funded incentive programs only allowed vaccine incentives to be paid for the first dose of somebody's vaccination. And so for you know, given some of the challenges that Elizabeth described earlier to get to that complete series, those incentive partners were able to provide incentives for people to come back for their second dose. And so the ways that ended up getting tailored varied a bit community to community as those dollars, those philanthropic funds were deployed, and be happy to do a deeper dive into what some of those strategies were. I think we're really eager to continue that work, given the effect that we think it's had on increasing the vaccination rates relative to where we started.
Thank you.
Representative Newbern-Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Grumdahl. That's actually really helpful. And then Ms. Dressel, I'm wondering on slide 13, you talked about some of the challenges you're experiencing. And I'm wondering, you talked specifically about accessing affordable housing for clients and connecting with landlords. I think this has been a problem in perpetuity. But I'm wondering specifically how that has been impacted by the new rent control measures in St. Paul. We certainly saw issues with builders halting projects and things like that. But I'm wondering if you guys have seen effects of that right off the bat, or if you have not waded that far into it yet.
Ms. Dressel?
Kathy might take that one for us. Kathy, go ahead.
Yeah, Chair Gomez and Representative Newbern-Lee, thank you. It's a good question. And the second part of your question is the truth. I don't know that we have any data or information about that impact yet.
Okay. Thank you. And I don't think that it's actually been, it's not in place yet, the rent control measure, but Representative Newbern-Lee.
Thanks so much, Madam Chair. Yeah, I don't think it's in place yet either, but obviously we're seeing other like impacts immediately on some other things happening there. So just curious about that. I am also curious, Ms. Tenbrooks, about your first slide on the new orientation of the council. And you said specifically, you mentioned that there are specific policies in place that are exacerbating racial disparities. And I'm wondering if you can help us understand what some of those specific policies are that are exacerbating racial disparities in homelessness right now.
Ms. Tenbrook.
Gomez, Representative Newbern-Lee, thank you. That is a huge question. So what I think I would like to do, if it's okay with you, is bring back some thoughts on our current policies. That's essentially what the task of this new iteration of our plan is intended to focus on, is how do we define what would justice look like for people experiencing homelessness? And then could we use that to essentially look at existing policies and programs and procedures to evaluate which ones essentially are racist or anti-racist in their outcomes in the work that we're doing. We know historically a great deal about some of our historic housing policies that have caused, you know, that kind of racial discrimination and disparity. But I think the intention now is to use this new frame to guide our existing work and look at existing policies to ensure that they are anti-racist.
Madam Chair.
Representative Newbern-Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the answer. And I think probably all of us agree that certainly there were historic policies in place that were explicitly racist. There's no question about it. I am not sure that there are identifiable policies in place right now. And so I would be very, very curious. You know, you mentioned that there are, and so I'd be curious to know what those are. And I would offer some caution. You know, it's frustrating. And in fact, frankly, Representative Thompson actually made some comments in another committee this morning that were right on about human beings. And I'm very concerned about us moving in a direction that we are not looking at homelessness in totality. We have certainly identified in this committee, and Representative Gomez and I have certainly agreed wholeheartedly on a focus on youth homelessness and trying to prevent children being homeless and hopefully stopping a cycle of homelessness in the process of that. But I sure hope that we will continue moving forward. I think that we actually have eliminated policies. That doesn't mean that we have eliminated issues in the hearts of all people, but we have certainly eliminated policies that that would create discrepancies based on race. If that is not true, I certainly hope that you identify those, because I am confident that we would have agreement on getting rid of any policy that that has any target based on race that would create racial disparities. That is not something that any of us would want. But I'm concerned about the approach that, frankly, we haven't been shown that any policies that exist today do. Now, don't get me wrong. I totally understand that some of those historic policies have long-term effects and long-term effects that we're still dealing with. But I would just be cautious in how we talk about that, and just ensure that, you know, frankly, homelessness is an issue across the board and it affects every community. And we need to end homelessness regardless of who is experiencing it, period, full stop. That is our goal here, is to end homelessness, period. That is our goal. That needs to be our goal. The other thing I would ask, you know, to Ms. Tenbrook, you talked about a prioritization of investments, and you asked providers, which is where you came up with slide 16. You talked to providers, and my question is, you know, I think a frustration shared by many of us. One thing, maybe the biggest takeaway from our last session when we really took a deep dive into this, is that we don't know the big picture. No one knows the big picture in homelessness right now. There are many, many different providers doing very good work, but we don't have a good comprehensive view about who all the providers are, what populations they're serving, what services are they providing, how effective are they? How do we know right now, and this would be my question to you, Ms. Tenbrook, how do we know right now which programs are the most effective and which programs we should be amplifying to make sure that our state dollars are doing the most good that they possibly can? How do we know that information right now?
Can I just so members know, we're a bit over time on this section. We need to save some time at the end to hear from Minnesotans who are experiencing homelessness. So I'm wondering if we can, you know, I think that this question.
This is my last question, by the way. Okay. I don't have anything else on my list.
Okay. If I can say two things. One is that, you know, I think that we need to kind of have a more in-depth conversation about the disparate outcomes of our policies and our investments that are reflected in that some of the data that we've seen today along racial lines. You know, so that's sort of like, I'm glad that you asked those questions. And I think that it's really important that we understand what it will take to address like the populations that are out there, where you have Native people being 24 times more likely to be in unsheltered homelessness. We can't have a race blind approach when that is the reality that we're dealing with on the ground. But, you know, I think that we should take more time to dig into that. The other piece is that, you know, I think that I'll let Director Tenbrook answer the question about kind of oversight, but like, I just want you to know, we haven't had a chance to connect, but like, but I want us to, you know, you put in a bill at the end of last session that we're taking a look at that I'm sending around. And so I'm excited to dig more deeply into that. And I'll pass it over to Director Tenbrook quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. And thank you, Representative New Brindley. Just in the interest of time, I mean, I will share that, of course, any of the agencies that are funded through the state go through monitoring and evaluation, sort of getting at that question in terms of the way they do their work and the impact they're having. But once again, I think it is a good, we could bring back to you a big picture of the scale of work across the state, the providers, who they're serving, what they do. But what we do know at the core, I think you started the question by sort of looking for the big picture. We do know at the core, based on our very significant gap in housing that's affordable or available to people experiencing homelessness. We do know that, and I think to your point earlier, that's something we all seem to very much agree on, of course, that is where our opportunity is to have the greatest impact on people's lives, is to really ensure that the kinds of housing opportunities that people need are available so that providers can do the work of connecting people to those solutions to their homelessness.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative New Brindley. We'll have more discussion about both of these last issues you brought up. Representative Davids, and if we could keep it brief again, because we need to get to our testifiers.
As you know, I'm always brief. Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's just a reminder for the committee that the 21-22 budget has been set with a 12% increase. And Madam Chair, you mentioned a $7.7 billion surplus. I think it's going to be over $8 billion. And again, this is not a budget year. This is a bonding year. And I just want to make sure we don't get in a situation here where we're overpromising and underperforming. I heard several people say how excited they are about the governor's budget. And let us remember that I think it's very good that you're hearing the governor's budget proposal. Very good. But as I've always said, the good thing about the governor's budget proposal is we do recycle the paper that it's written on. So I think we have to come back to reality as soon as we can. And once we get through the governor's budget presentation, which is good to do, I've always done his tax chair. I always hear his proposals, and we do debate them. But I really think that we have to, we will have to get to a number, and I know it's kind of early, as soon as we can. And what do we have to work with? Because I do not want to see a huge bill to prevent homelessness coming out of the House, and you hear a very loud thud when it hits the Senate floor. I want to avoid that. I want to do all we can in this committee to prevent homelessness, but I think we have to get real on the numbers. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davids, for keeping us grounded in the challenge ahead. Representative Hollins.
Sure, I'll be pretty quick. Thank you, presenters. This has been really informational, and I really appreciate it. I've been in touch with a couple of different folks who are unsheltered who are who tell me they're very afraid to go into the shelters that are being provided by the state and by the cities because they feel that they're COVID hotbeds. And so I was wondering if you had any advice on how to communicate to them what preventative measures are happening or how to address that issue, you know, in its reality.
I'm not sure who wanted to take that question from the presenting team.
Chair Gomez, I can take
that. Yes, Director Tenbrook.
Chair Gomez, Representative Hollis, thank you. So I think a couple of things. One, in our weekly webinars with providers all across the state, that does include some people experiencing homelessness as well who have been really important trusted messengers out to community. We go over every week the various levels of guidance and support for shelters and opportunities for resources for shelters to make their spaces as safe as they possibly can. Of course, understanding right now at the level of Omicron statewide, it's been more and more difficult. So I think two things are true. It is absolutely understandable why people are concerned to be inside in spaces that are congregate in nature. That's the very reason, of course, that we are seeing some of the greatest challenges for people experiencing homelessness is their health vulnerability, but also in many cases, the settings where they are essentially needing to be in order to be inside are congregate in nature. So understandable. And two, we are, I think, doing everything we possibly can to share the best possible guidance from our MDH team out to providers. Providers have done a really tremendous job of doing all they can to make their spaces as safe as possible. And with all of that said, you know, it is still a true concern, and the very nature of why housing instability and homelessness has been such an important public health concern during this pandemic. So thank you for the question.
Thank you. Representative Ryer, did you have a quick question?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be quick. I just wanted to comment on two things. One, that the alignment of the new vision focusing on achieving justice rather than counting on the outcome rather than the inputs and the outputs, I think is really valuable and important. policies need to have the desired outcome. And what happens is that policies, even if they don't have explicitly racist words in them and they don't stand out as some old style racist policies might, have assumptions baked into them that come from the perspective of the people who formed them. And that's really structured around who's at the table in creating policy. So my hope, I won't even ask for a response, but my hope and my expectation is that when we're doing the policy review, that the perspectives of all are represented so that we don't continue to see disparities like the 24 times more likely to have these experiences if you're part of the Native community. Because when you want to treat something and get to the goal that I share with Representative New Brindley of ending homelessness across the board, you must focus on the unique and individual needs, and you must focus first where the problems are more acute, and that's how you bring about a total solution. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Breyer. It's a good note to end on, I think. So next, and I'm sorry that we're behind time here, but we're going to turn over to Hennepin County Commissioner Angela Conley, who has led on these issues in our biggest county that faces unique issues. So I'm just going to turn it over to her. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Say your name for the record and then proceed with it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good morning. My name is Angela Conley, and I am a Hennepin County Commissioner representing the 4th District. And on the board, I chair the Health and Human Services Committee. So I'd like to give you a kind of a brief overview here. I want to first thank you all for the opportunity to testify before the committee today. Your work really, truly is vital to Minnesotans and real people, depending upon the good work that you do, some of whom are here today. Combined with our federal funding partners, we, counties, cities, and the state made historic investments that allow us to be one step closer to preventing homelessness and to support persons and families experiencing homelessness. So first of all, I want to thank you, especially thank you for the Family and Youth Homelessness Prevention Program that you authorized in last year's tax bill. This funding will be absolutely critical to better design a system to prevent family and youth homelessness and to bolster the continuum. After several tries, you know, we were also able to finally secure a youth homelessness award from the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development. And Hennepin was also successful in expanding projects funded through the state's Homework Starts with Home program. With the additional supportive funds from the state starting in 2023, we are currently in the planning process, and assessments and design will be led by persons and families with lived experience. The funding that you provide to Hennepin County will sustain that expanded system of prevention, and the federal government helped us plan and you helped us serve, so thank you. Some highlights from Hennepin County. Our vision for our services continuum is to ensure that homelessness is rare, brief, and non-recurring, and that all residents have equitable access to increased housing stability. And we do this by minimizing new entries to homelessness, increasing transitions from homelessness into permanent housing, and financing affordable housing along the housing continuum. Hennepin County administers $146 million every year toward that vision. In addition, we have committed $91.35 million in American Rescue Plan funding, that's 38% of our ARP award, toward homeless services and affordable housing development that really prioritizes our lowest income households. And this includes $46 million towards an equitable housing recovery, more than $45 million in homelessness infrastructure and services, such as the Avivo Villages and AICDC Homeward Bound shelters, 24/7 opening of existing shelters, and housing-focused case management to really help people in shelter and unsheltered settings move into permanent housing. We do have a looming fiscal cliff, though, and so I want to talk about that for a moment. These services face an $11 million annual financial cliff when the ARP funds end in 2024, in addition to $2 million, a $2 million annual cliff to operate Avivo Villages starting in 2023, and $14 million in shelter capital needs. We desperately need ongoing sustainable funding for shelter operations and homeless response. Pre-pandemic, Hennepin County property tax was the largest source of public funding supporting shelter programs for single adults. And even with ARP funds, needs still exceed what our level of government can provide. And that leaves our providers trying to raise a significant amount of private funds. So I have to be honest with you that it is not sustainable, and we are going to need expanded state support to ensure that we have no gaps and that all in need are served. So I'll give you some examples of that funding cliff. Hennepin has a network of shelters in need of state investment in capital and in services. Avivo. In the case of the innovative new Avivo Villages project, the City of Minneapolis is matching Hennepin County's contribution with funds that expire at the end of this year. At that point, there will be an annual funding gap of roughly $2 million. That gap will grow to $4 million when ARP is no longer available. Simpson Housing. We have also committed $3.5 million to develop the new Simpson shelter. The current facility is old. It has reached the end of its useful life, and it's an old church that is quite literally falling apart. I've been on site. I've seen it. Minneapolis is matching our award, and Simpson raised a similarly impressive sum from private funders, but there is a sizable gap in funding for the new facility that remains. We desperately need state capital support at the level comparable with the commitment made by the county. The project is shovel ready. It only lacks the final piece of state funding, and the remaining funding gap for the Simpson Shelter project is around $4 million. There is a bonding request, but the need is so imminent that I do think it's fair to say that the state finance part was needed yesterday. St. Stephen's. St. Stephen's House of Charity are operating out of a temporary facility, and they do need to develop a new site. They will face the same funding challenges that Simpson did, but given timelines, are less likely to benefit from ARP. They desperately need state capital support in the amount of $10 million by 2024. Some other funding needs. Given what I've just shared, I want to place our needs into two categories here, project-specific needs and then ongoing program support. So for project needs, Hennepin County strongly supports the governor's supplemental budget request for shelter capital funding. This pool would definitely help us with the Simpson project. And remember that this project can't wait. It needs $4 million immediately. And particularly the St. Stephen's House of Charity request. You know, we also strongly support the governor's request for increases to the emergency shelter program. But I need to note here that as large as this request is, it does not come close to meeting the needs in the metro alone. You can see this in what Ramsey County is seeking and our own ARP-related financing cliff. For program needs, we support the governor's overall housing budget. An effective shelter and homeless response system is necessary to reduce homelessness. And we loudly applaud the request and also remind you that it is still not 100% of the funds that is currently needed. We want to challenge you to ensure that shelter and homeless response funding be committed to the highest priority projects as directed by the local community. In Hennepin County, that has been identified as the Avivo Villages, which needs the $2 million annually starting next year. When the ARP funding cliff hits at the end of 2024, there will be a further $11 million a year gap in funds for Avivo Villages, AICDC Homeward Bound, 24-hour opening of shelters and case management. We absolutely cannot go backwards here. We know it's tempting to fund the projects that can come here and engage you directly, but they aren't always the ones that are the most important to prevention and services continuum. We also want to request that you prioritize awards that serve people who earn less than 30% of the average median income. I'm speaking specifically to programs for rental assistance and subsidies for permanent housing, the latter of which needs to target deeply affordable housing, which focuses on those in the lowest income bracket. These are the only ways really to truly address homelessness in the long term, and often the only ways that we are to actually prevent homelessness from occurring in the first place. To continue here, you know, I know that housing is at the heart of this division's jurisdiction, but to prevent and end homelessness, we need to examine the entire social safety net and make sure that it's accessible. There's so many ways that Minnesota's human services programs fail the people they are designed to help. Hennepin County has several recommendations that we'd be happy to share at another time, and we'll be present. Presenting them to the committees of their jurisdictions. Several members of this committee, however, sit on that. And so, Madam Chair, with your indulgence, I want to just highlight a few here. For housing supports, I think you'd all be surprised that despite the recent reforms, there are several disincentives built into the housing support program, and this is formerly known as GRH. While it is an incredible resource for communities, it also leaves people with disabilities receiving SSI, paying almost 90% of their income towards housing. This traps people in poverty while leading others to choose continued homelessness or return to homelessness as a result. We want to call on the state to improve the program in partnership with counties and tribes to increase utilization and to reduce homelessness. Also, continuous eligibility. Programs that provide childcare subsidies, emergency assistance, and work supports have paperwork requirements that are onerous on persons who are unstably housed and whose economic circumstances make them vulnerable to homelessness. And since this is the Preventing Homelessness Division, I want to invite you to consider the lower hanging fruit. Work with us, counties, on proposals we have to ensure that these safety net programs are accessible to vulnerable families and individuals. If counties have proven anything during this pandemic, it's that we can deliver services in innovative ways that make them more accessible and maintain program integrity. Sadly, our hands remain tied in taking these reforms further, and we greatly welcome your help in serving our residents. And I'll wrap up just by thanking you for the opportunity to talk about what we are doing at Hennepin County and to ensure that homelessness stays rare, brief, and non-recurring. I want to thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, and happy to take questions.
Thank you so much, Commissioner Conley. We really appreciate all that you shared with us today. We have a few minutes if there's like one question, but we really need to kind of wrap it up so we can hear from some of our directly impacted communities. I know that Commissioner Conley shared some materials with us, and you know, we share priorities, and so we're going to be hearing bills on a lot of the specifics that you mentioned. Not seeing any questions for Commissioner Conley, thank you again so much for joining us on this day. We really appreciate the perspective that you bring, you know, just to frame this issue for us as we're doing our work over the next few months. So our gratitude to you. So next, we will be hearing from some folks who have experienced homelessness or are experiencing homelessness. So we're going to just jump right into it, but I want to really thank, you know, I think that for me, one of the most meaningful parts of our committee last year was hearing from people who were in different places in their lives with respect to these issues. You know, some who, you know, we heard from people who were currently living in encampments. We heard from people who had experienced homelessness in the past and now had turned to kind of, you know, helping others in that situation, and it really brought a lot of rich perspective. So we're going to go to our first testifier, Sandy Kelting. Welcome to the committee, Sandy. If you could just say your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Sandy Kelting, and I am so glad to be here. I love my street family. I was out there for 7 years, and I've never been happier in my life, and felt such unconditional love and no judgment, and I can go out in public looking like this now and not even care, because they love you just the way you are and give you the shirt off their back. It's such a heartfelt community. So thank you very much for allowing me to be here, and fierce love for them, for all of us.
Thank you. Please go ahead, Sandy, if you have anything else you wanted to share with us.
Yes. I just got a beautiful apartment. It was time. And because I've always felt if I'm out there being positive, I'm doing enough. And the negativity was setting in. So I thought, okay, I'm not being a good influence out here, trying to, you know, finally go in. And it's beautiful. I'm so happy. But I'm also so grateful for the experience. I used to be judgmental when I was young. I even looked at a homeless person when I was newly married. Get a job at McDonald's. And now, after being dragged through the mud, I don't know who that person was. And I wouldn't trade it for the world. But anyhow, I have been kicked out of every place in Minneapolis. I had 5 cops kick me off a strip of grass in front of the library because I was reading. It's way better now. COVID brought the tent camps. We were sleeping on park benches and on the train, and they literally, if they saw you had a, it was such discrimination. And so humans are not garbage ever. And we can't be invisible. People are happy to be camping in tents in the wintertime and having some integrity. You know, I used to wake up on the train surrounded by business people while I'm drooling on my backpack. And now, you know, COVID brought the tents. It's, you know, it was helpful. Now they are taking care of the volunteers are like guardian angels, bringing meals and telling us they love us. You know, it's a beautiful turnaround and it's getting better. People are never human garbage. I mean, you know, homeless people can't be invisible. They can't disappear. They have to be somewhere. I don't understand. They tried to evict us March 18th last year. It was the most terrifying moment of my life. I came out of the porta potty and
Sandy, I think we just lost your audio.
Oops.
Okay, sorry. So you were saying that, you know, you were telling us about the eviction in March.
Yes. My first thought was we didn't do anything wrong. You know, and my second thought was, we don't have a plan. We're not going to be together. And that was my biggest fear was we had plans before that for places to go as a group, because I loved it. I loved being surrounded. It was like a commune, you know, just people are right there who love you. Just feel the energy of people who accept you just the way you are. And I just remember thinking, we don't have a plan. We're going to get separated. And it was so terrifying. And it's like, these people were on this lot that the city owns. Nobody's using it. You know, the neighborhood wrote us a letter saying they love us and support us. And years ago, there was an article before they redid Nicollet, how when they made the skyways, it was to keep the professionals away from the homeless people. It's like, well, this is out of the city on a lot out in the middle of nowhere. You want us back? You know, flow in the city. It's like these people have to, if they're settled and content, and, you know, why do they have to do the eviction, waste all that money instead of using the money to get a warehouse, you know, buy a big warehouse, let the tents be in there, buy an apartment building. It seems like there's so much money going out. If they bought an apartment building, they wouldn't need staff. They wouldn't need, you know, people wouldn't feel under their thumbs by these abusive, you know, so-called shelters I was in one for 4 years and the staff was horrible. It was nothing but mental abuse to strip people of what little dignity they had left when they walked through those doors. They'd been abused enough by life. And I did not ever see one kind word from the front desk. I saw them laughing at people and pointing out the window. I dealt with emotional abuse in my past, my parents and my marriage, and I know what it's like. And even though I was fully aware of it, it still beat me down. And it was just so unacceptable. That's why people are outside, because I would rather laid down in a sleeping bag and frozen to death before I would have gone back to that shelter. It was that bad. When you're afraid to ask one question for fear that you're going to get yelled at or told you're separated, which means you have to leave and take all your stuff with you for 24 hours, you know, these punishments, that's abuse, you know, and people don't want to be in those places. Go figure. But they are making huge bucks. What if they bought an apartment building? They wouldn't need those staff people or any staff people, because we know how to live in an apartment all by ourselves. It's the thumb over people that's why people are out there, because the oppression, you know, it's not right to treat humans that way. And there's so much money. The one I was in, it was disgusting. And it's like, advocate, you're supposed to be helping us, kind of like other things going on in this world. You're supposed to be the ones helping us. We're not here for your convenience. You know, it's like, just, it was worse there than out in the streets. And it has gotten so much better with the campgrounds. You know, maybe it's messy, you know? It's like, I saw such creative people and so proud they'd be building. And, you know, it's like my son used to do that when he was little. They'd build forts, and my ex-husband used to get mad. You know, it's messy. It's so embarrassing. No, they're creative and they're proud. It's so proud of it. Oh, and, you know, so yeah, they get messy, but life is messy. People are messy, but they're not trash. And I thank you. I really am proud of my street family and proud that I was accepted. And who knew? Rock bottom. And it's the happiest I've been in my life. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Kelting, for your testimony. We really appreciate you being with us today. Thank you. Next, we have Peyton LaFont. Welcome to the committee. If you could just say your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony. Probably keep it to about 3 or 4 minutes.
I will. Hi, I'm Peyton LaFont. I am 27 years old, and I have experienced homelessness. From 12 years old up until I was 23 years old, I was homeless in Duluth, Minnesota. My main resource was Lifehouse at that time. Without their support, I don't know where I'd be. They welcomed me with open arms here. Have taught me a lot of life skills. At one point I had went I had experienced drug addiction. They supported me through that entire situation. Not only am I 7 years or 6 years sober, but thank you. As well as at that time, you know, they had got me housing by the time I was 18. And then I had messed it up due to my drug addiction. I had gotten into drugs and my mental health was pretty much falling. And at that time, was I ready to keep my housing? No. Was I ready to get housing? And they knew that, you know, helping me with resources such as getting my mental health under control and getting my drug addiction under control was one of our main priorities and focuses before getting me housing again. Because why house somebody who is not ready to be housed yet? Because for all I know, I could have got that housing and I would have used it as, you know, a way to an outlet to keep using my drugs or, you know, in that sense. I also feel like that's another reason a lot of people are, you know, still homeless, is they need that services like Lifehouse or The Link or, you know, other services like that, you know, to help with the mental health, to help with the stabilization of drug and alcohol. Anyway, yes, they housed me again, but when I was at least one of my favorite staff members at my program. Made me wait 60 days, got me into a shelter, and made me prove myself that I was going to stay off the drugs and get my mental health under control. And once I proved that, got me housing and stabilization. I was there for a year. Now I am in my own building or in my own place. I am now a behavioral analyst for REM Arrowhead, very successful in reaching out to others. I also worked at Northwest Children's Home with children who are also experiencing homelessness or mental health issues. And now my goal, just from the resources they provided me, I am now equipped to help others. I can't say I'm thankful enough for this program. Without this, I don't know where I would be. But I am very glad they kind of like raised me. Mm-hmm. With that being said, that's all I really got for you guys.
Thank you so much, Peyton, for sharing that with us. And congratulations on your new place and on 6 years sober. That's incredible. Amazing work. It's the hardest thing to do, as a lot of us know. So thanks a lot for being here with us today and for giving back to your community in the way that you are. Finally,
thanks for having me.
Thank you. Finally, we're going to hear from Oasis Shannon, I believe. Are you with us? If you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. I'm sorry, Sherman, excuse me. I like wrote it down on my paper and I couldn't understand my own handwriting.
Okay.
Oasis Sherman, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Oasis Sherman, and I live here in Bloomington, Minnesota, representing the Oasis for Youth. Now, I'm actually not from here. I was born in San Francisco, California, and I grew up in the foster care system in Albany, Georgia. It took me about 12 years to find my family, and I moved here with my dad at 16 years old. It was quite a rough start, to be honest, because after all, me and my dad were just getting to know each other. And if it wasn't for Oasis for Youth to be here with me, they really helped me embark on new territory and really get established here. They were there for me when I graduated from high school as a young mother, and they connected me with daycares and helped provide me with transportation, getting back and forth to the places I needed to go. And they were there for me, making sure I had all the resources that I needed as a young mother to really help me make sure that I had one less thing to worry about. And some of those resources were connecting me with a public health nurse and even helping me get medical insurance for my daughter and I. And after graduating high school as a new mother, they even helped ready me for employment in the new world of being a mom, and they gave me an amazing job opportunity to be a liaison and advocate for young people in experiencing homelessness in Minnesota's Southwest suburban area. And to be honest, without programs like Oasis for Youth, young mothers like me and other youth in the suburban areas would really be lost and confused without anyone to turn to. And so I say to you all, why not expand the resources and programs the suburbs have to offer our youth? Because after all, we are the future of the world.
Thank you so much, Oasis. Thank you for sharing a little bit about your story. And thank you also for, you know, turning really hard experiences in your life and like transforming that into a drive to serve your community. It's a beautiful thing to see. And we really, really appreciate it and appreciate you sharing your story. I just wanted to quickly say, you know, that I think our last two testifiers just sort of lift up what is going to be a priority for us and in the governor's budget, which is, you know, making sure that young people, you know, in this really critical time in their lives from 16 to 24 have the support that they need to launch into their lives successfully, as these two young people have done, and to become stabilized. And so, you know, we really thank you for your advocacy and for being here today and for lifting up kind of the possibility that can come out of really making sure that we're investing in programs that work for young people, and especially for young parents. I just wanted to mention, you know, that's particularly like we need to support our young people who are becoming parents, their babies, as we move forward. So with that, thank you so much for being here, everyone. Great conversation during our first committee hearing. And our next hearing will be Wednesday, February 9th. Sorry, our next committee meeting, where I think we are going to start hearing bills, is Wednesday, February 9th. We meet at 10:30. And with that, we are adjourned.